नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। First of all, welcome back. So good to see you all again. To resuming these readings after a 3-week pause while I was in a solo retreat. Also, just like to acknowledge the tragedies in Ukraine. I'm sure people have been appraised a bit of the news, and it's a terrible invasion happening there, and the immense amount of suffering being caused. So oftentimes people consider or wonder, what can we do or how can we help? But I would suggest that living here, practicing the Dhamma, practicing meditation, reflecting on the teachings and dedicating our lives towards that which is wholesome and good, then from that commitment, that interest, that activity, that dedication, then that ripples out into the world through our various lives in various ways, now and into the future. And so that I would like to dedicate these readings and whatever goodness that comes forth from that for the well-being of the people in that region. And so please do bear that in mind. Also, with respect to the readings and contents, please can we stay on the theme of the book and the readings rather than getting into discussions about politics and broader global issues? I'd appreciate that. So I thought I would just repeat the last section. Some of you might not remember where we were 3 weeks ago. I see a few new faces as well, those who weren't around before. So just repeat the last section. We're on the chapter called The Third Exit Point from the Cycle. And I believe the last thing that we read was Cessation and Non-Arising, the apostrophe. So forgive me if I'm wrong, but that's what I marked as the last bit I read. The word Nirodha is often translated as cessation, quote unquote, implying a thing that has begun, then comes to an end. But it also means the non-arising of something, or the restraining, limiting of something. The word Nirodha thus is a convention of language that indicates an absence. Just as an apostrophe, or from your side, an apostrophe is a mark that indicates some letters have been left out of an English phrase, as in would have for would have, or isn't for is not, or it's for it is. The word dukkha nirodha represents an absence of dukkha, an absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. It is a something that indicates a nothing. It makes the reader conscious of a significant absence. When there is vijja, there's awareness. Avijja doesn't arise. The whole cycle of birth and death, that division into subject and object, me and the world, is not given any fuel. This third exit point from the cycle is thus positioned before avijja appears, or after it has been dispelled. We might find this puzzling or strange, or we might find our mind wanting to work out the logic of how it all fits together. But instead of trying to figure it all out, just watch how it works. When the heart is established in that quality of the selfless, bright simplicity of knowing, notice how there is an absence of me in the world. There's seeing, hearing, feeling, remembering, but that flow of perception and feeling is not accompanied by the sense of I, or me, or mine, or such like. There is the absence of the feeling of alienation that comes with that. There's a naturalness, a simplicity and a beauty to each moment. Even if what is being perceived is not pleasant or is very ordinary, the heart is still able to fully enjoy each moment because of the full attunement of the heart to its own nature. So similarly, in the, I'm not sure if I quoted it last time, but the teaching of the Buddha to Bahia, who was a wanderer who had He thought he was enlightened, but it was revealed to him by a devata who came to visit that he wasn't enlightened and wasn't even on the way to being enlightened. And then he asked, well, are there any enlightened beings in the world? And this deva said, yes, actually, in the Savati you'll find the Buddha Gautama. And Bahia set off walking, and walked several hundred miles from where he was on the coast of India to Savati, and met the Buddha in the street. And then asking the Buddha for his teaching, and not wanting to wait until they were back, could get back to the monastery, and encouraging the Buddha to speak then and there because of the fragility, the uncertain nature of life, then the Buddha gave this very simple teaching, very direct, simple teaching about perception and not self. He said, in the seen there is only the seen, in the heard there is only the heard, in the sensed there is only the sensed, in the cognized there is only the cognized. This Bahia is how you should train yourself. If it's recognized that in the seen there is only the seen and so forth, then it will be recognized that there is no thing here, there is no subject, no substantial separate experiencer or subject. And when it's recognized there's no thing here, it will also be seen that there's no thing there. No, the object is, the world of the object is also empty. And so when it is recognized that there is no thing there, you will not be able to find yourself either in the world of this or in the world of that, or any place between the two. This Bahia is the end of dukkha. And Bahia became an arahant right there and then in the street. So from not being on the path to enlightenment a few weeks before, he realized the full enlightenment right there in the street on that very short teaching, and he was recognized as being the one who understood the teaching most quickly. And he was also right about uncertainty, as he was knocked down by a runaway cow in the street and died in the Savati shortly after he'd met the Buddha. So he was right. So it's one of those famous incidents of the Pali Canon, the Bahia Sutta. You find it in the Udana, the inspired utterances. There's no need to believe or disbelieve these words. Experiment. We can explore for ourselves. In our clearest moments, how is the experience of this being and the world? How is it? The inner world and the outer world, how does it feel? This third exit point from the cycle is thus related to the third noble truth, dukkha nirodha, the cessation of suffering. Just as with the first two noble truths, the Buddha gave an instruction on how to work with this third noble truth, he named the task as, it is to be realized, appreciated, fully taken to heart. Idam dukkha nirodho aryasacchang sacchikātabanti. This means that the ending of dukkha is to be wholly appreciated, embodied, known as real. Otherwise, how could the heart fully imbibe that delightful truth that there is no dukkha? You might think that such an appreciation would go without saying, but the conditioning of the perceptual process tends to work against this. Say, for example, we're sitting and we hear a continuous sound, the sound of traffic or the humming of the fridge. When that sound stops, there are a few seconds of ah, as we realize that the unpleasant, quote-unquote, sound has stopped. In the same way, we only notice nirodha, cessation of suffering, in contrast to the presence of some dukkha. After a few seconds of the absence of the irritating sound, has become ordinary, and so the mind ignores that absence. After a few seconds of the absence of the irritating sound has become ordinary, I'll read that a third time. After a few seconds, the absence of that irritating sound has become ordinary, and so the mind ignores that absence. Ignorance has literally been established once again. So does that make sense? I think everyone's familiar with that, the kind of experience, like a plane passing over, or the vehicles stop going past, or the fridge, the humming of the fridge stops, and you go, oh, I hadn't even noticed that was happening. But there's a conscious appreciation of that absence, and then after a few seconds, then that absence is not anything significant. There's no message carried there, and so the perceptual process ignores it. Nothing happening. The silence of the fridge is not something that catches our attention. You know, if you walk into a room and the fridge isn't humming, we don't think, "Oh, the fridge is quiet." Would imagine. So that say that absence of dukkha, sacchikātabanti, saccha means truth or reality, so sacchikātabanti, it needs to be made real, or it's and needs to be fully appreciated, fully fully known. But any questions, thoughts? Silence. Okay, we'll continue. So the next section is called Eating is More Interesting Than Peace. The challenge of the Third Noble Truth is to sustain that awareness of no dukkha. This is challenging because peace is not interesting. Silence is not interesting. Space is not interesting. It doesn't catch our attention because our senses are geared towards noticing what you can eat, what's going to eat you, what you need to protect and provide for, what to compete with, and what is going to be valuable. The senses are for things that are going to be pleasant or painful, so that we have to train our senses to notice peace, to notice space, to notice silence, and to stay with it. This is what Satchikata Bhanti, the realization of dukkha nirodha, means. And on that, there's a chapter in the book by Lupo Sumedha, Mindfulness, the Path to the Deathless, called Noticing Space. Probably quite a few of you are familiar with that. Also in his collected teachings, Noticing Space, he goes into that in quite some detail. As this was a very, very frequent theme of Lumpur's teaching, exactly what I was saying, it's an element that is, it's sort of glossed over. The attention goes to dukkha and the causes of dukkha, suffering and craving. They're much more sort of vibrant and attention catching. And I think in this respect, it's helpful to consider our kind of instinctual heritage, the sort of evolutionary effects of the senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Our senses are very, very ancient. They literally go back like hundreds of millions of years into the past. The capacity to hear or see or to sense environment. Even some microscopic creatures, all sort of monocellular creatures, they know it's attractive, it's edible, move towards it. It's dangerous, it's poisonous, move away from it. I think it's helpful to understand and respect that the conditioning of the senses is extremely ancient, powerful, and so in this effort to notice space or to realize the ending of dukkha, to be fully acknowledging, realizing that it's work. It's going against the habits of literally hundreds of millions of years that our inherited senses and how they operate, how they work, how they function, and the conditioning of them. So it's not impossible, of course, but it means that it's an effort that needs to be made to bring about that kind of recognition. In that respect, Lumpo Sumedha would often say, the third noble truth is the most difficult one to live with or to work with, and it's the most important. It's the kind of it's the good news of the whole thing. It's the kind of the end result of the effort of reflecting on the Four Noble Truths and working with them is dukkha nirodha, the ending of dukkha. He said many times, I teach one thing, suffering and the ending of suffering, dukkha and dukkha nirodha. And so it's the point of the whole thing is dukkha nirodha, but it's also the thing that's most easy to miss. And so Lumpo Sumedha often would give this particular noble truth more attention than the others. The instruction in the sutta is dukkha nirodha should be realized. Those of you who have been students of Ajahn Sumedho, listened to his Dhamma talks, or read his books, will know that he puts a lot of attention onto this theme. He will often use a catchy phrase like, peace is really boring. This is because silence, space, stillness, and peace are not exciting according to our normal habits of perception. But when we let go of those habitual ways of perceiving and open the heart to silence, space, peacefulness, stillness, the ending of dukkha, that initial impression of being uninteresting or boring falls away as a kind of blossoming. He would also often illustrate this by saying, using examples like if they published a newspaper with a banner headline, Ajahn's Buddhist monk breathes in and breathes out, so you wouldn't sell many papers. And this was a frequent theme of his Dhamma talks. He wouldn't sell many newspapers, you know, banner headline, Buddhist monk breathes in and breathes out. Like, so, big deal. But he said, if he says, Buddhist monk runs away with a 16-year-old girl, oh, goodness, how terrible, how awful, you know, let me read it. And so that which is kind of startling or shocking or frightening or irritating gets our attention. That which is ordinary slides past. It's like, so a human being breathes, yeah, it's not news. Yeah. Why would I be interested? For example, let's say you are looking for someone. You look in the living room and it's empty. There's nobody there. Nothing interesting here. So you take off and search some other rooms. What if instead, as you come into the empty space of the living room, you stop and attune to that space, the stillness and silence? The heart opens to the presence of the moment. There's the recognition that the Dhamma is here and now. How could it not be? In that moment, if there's a real openness of heart, if there is a realization of the quality of stillness, silence, spaciousness, there is a profound richness and beauty in that absence. In the Thai language, the word for ordinary, tamada, is derived from the Pali word meaning of the nature of ultimate reality, dhammata. Hidden in the ordinary is the ultimate. If you open up the packet, you find the great treasure inside. This is dukkha nirodha, which is recognized by the awakened awareness of the heart. So that even written in the spelling of the Thai word, the same letters as for the word Dhamma is in there, Dhammada. So that the clue is not just in the sound, but also in the way the word is written, Dhammada. If you forgive me for my bad pronunciation. Dhammada, ordinary. Dhamma. So Dhammata, the ta means of the nature, or the nature of. Dhammata means of the nature of Dhamma. Does that make sense? Any questions? Yes.
About
a billion years, I think.
Human existence, that we tend to go for the what we like and so on. But then we have to work against this. It is not also our own conditioning from our own past lifetime.
That's all part of it. I mean, it's our past lives and also just the conditioning of the body, the whole thing.
It's like a mixture of both.
Mm-hmm. Just like our bodies are a mixture of our ancestors. You know, our parents, grandparents, and all the generations before. These bodies are a mixture of influences of everyone who's gone before us in terms of our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on. So that our what influences the habits of the senses in this moment is both having a human body and the conditioning of this life, but also what conditioning there might be from previous lifetimes. So yeah, it's a mixture of those influences.
Past, come
up,
but collective, like from past.
Well, it's collective insofar as like yeah, your accent is influenced by having been born in Romania, right? So your language is spoken by lots and lots of people around you when you were growing up. So it's a kind of group, quote-unquote, group karma or group influence, because everyone's speaking the same language. So that's, yes, you're influenced by that, because there's other people around doing the same things. Just like the way that we're sitting. We're in a Buddhist monastery. We have customs of sitting on mats and cushions. You know, people are sitting on the mats and the cushions, or on the chairs. You know, you're not sitting on the carpet or standing here looking over my shoulder. The conventions of gathering together in a Buddhist monastery, it's like this. This is kind of how we do things here. It's a sort of group agreement or a group behavior. So we're influenced by each other. And what we've learned is sort of the way things are done, or what is normal, like speaking English or speaking Romanian or such like. So we're influenced by the things around us. And then, of course, from previous lifetimes, and then where we've been and what's happened in those lifetimes, it will have had its influence too. But the Buddha pointed out, one of the imponderables, the acintaya, is all of the influences and workings of karma and its results. It's one of the four imponderables, the acintaya. So figuring out all of the influences that make my experience of this moment exactly like this is like, it's totally incalculable. You can't piece it all together.
Because then, for example, I like something,
mm-hmm.
and I'm attracted to this thing, and this thing of liking is unwholesome, craving. And that if it makes like from condition, from million, whatever, of lifetime, of like human existence, then it's not my karma. It's not my intention that brought
that. No. No, but things have their influence. And so the way that the mind has related or reacted to those influences is part of the karmic complex. So you're not sort of personally responsible. Like, I didn't invent English language, but I experienced the effect of this being the language that I grew up with and that I speak and that I use. So not all of the things that influence our lives are the results of our personal action. There's the influence, there's the laws of physics and chemistry, the laws of biology, the society that we're born into. There's many, many influences. So the results of personal choices is only one element that comes to make up what we're experiencing in this moment. So I would say many of the things that we experience are not the results of personal choices.
But those are not dukkha.
They don't have to be, no, no, no.
But the thing I think about that our dukkha is our own responsibility.
Our
inner suffering,
mm-hmm.
it's our responsibility. Our karma is because of our own action. Of own intention, either to I'm not aware, I'm not mindful, and I react to something, dislike, like, ignorantly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my own. It's because of me.
The dukkha, the kind of the mental dukkha that comes from the experience of the present is to do with the mind's attachment to like and dislike, and the attitude that the mind has to what is seen, smelt, tasted, touched, heard, and so on.
So that is the thing that drives me towards the object, towards the things I don't like or I like. So, maybe that is also influenced by many other factors,
yeah.
I don't know which one, but it's still our responsibility.
Yeah, so we can't, like, that, I feel it's very helpful that the Buddha laid out that, you know, the workings of karma are achintaya, they're imponderable. But also in other teachings where he talks about what are they called, the niyamas, the laws of nature, that in this moment what we experience is the results of the laws of physics and chemistry, the laws of biology and evolution. We experience the results of personal choices. So you have utu niyama, bija niyama, kama niyama is the third one. That's the only one that's related to our personal choices. Then citta niyama is the way that the mind works. And then dhamma niyama is the fifth one. So in each moment, we all experience the effects of those laws, physics, chemistry, biology, evolution, personal choice, the psychology, the way the mind works, and the ultimate nature of reality. All of that is, it comes together to make up the experience of this moment. So it's super kind of a super achintaya, you know, maha achintaya. It's really imponderable, but we can know in this moment it feels like this, and in this moment the mind can not be creating dukkha out of the what is seen, heard, smelt, tasted, touched, thought, wherever it's come from, whatever the sources are, the mind can know it and not create dukkha about it. That's the kind of the great insight of the Buddha when he and why he kept his teaching focused on the Four Noble Truths, and he wouldn't talk about what's the ultimate origin of things, or, you know, the first, he said no first beginning is describable. And whereas many religious traditions and mythologies would talk about a first cause or how things began, the Buddha realized right from the get-go, absolutely no point. Any words you could use couldn't describe the reality, and it's not useful anyhow. It's just an idea. What's important is in this moment, dukkha and ending dukkha. That's what matters. So he saw that right from the beginning, and that was the focus of his teaching. So we don't need to be able to map where every single influence has come from to make up this moment, why we think, you know, the way we do. I mean, I find I repeat phrases that my father used repeating his father. My grandfather died in 1930. I never met him, but I use his phrases because my dad used to use them. And so I've inherited, you know, little phrases that my grandfather used. You know, I was born in 1956. He died in 1930. But I'm influenced by things that he used to say. So that's, but I don't have to make a problem out of that. But I can recognize, oh, there's an influence there. I hear myself using that phrase about looking after a fire, you know, a wood fire. That I know where it's come from, but the mind doesn't have to make anything out of it. So we can extend that to all of the different things that come together to make up this life. That's why the Buddha over and over says, I teach one thing, dukkha and the ending of dukkha. You don't need to be able to write mathematical equations for how every single instrument in the orchestra functions. You can listen to the music of the orchestra and know, oh, in this moment, it sounds exactly like this. So that's an incredible insight and extraordinarily helpful, because a lot of religious traditions spend huge amounts of time sort of trying to sort of debate and decide things that are really outside of the scope of direct knowledge, but the mind likes to theorize around them. And the Buddha saw, it's not necessary. Just focus on this one thing. It's a deliberate leaving aside all of the extra material, and on the central theme of an incredibly vast subject. So that's what matters. Okay? I will continue. I will continue.
Then why we speak so much?
Why do I speak so much?
No, why we speak so much?
Why do you speak so much? Well, it's Might be my influence. speaking of finding the wonderful within the ordinary, there's an interesting story from Thailand about, and maybe I told it last time, but it's a kind of a, sort of also the mythology of the ugly duckling. You know, the duckling that thought it was really ugly and was rejected, and then it realized that it wasn't an ugly duckling, it was a swan. So when it grew up, it turned into a swan. So that the mistake of the ugly duckling was that it didn't realize that in its own nature was that swanhood. But in Thailand, there was a in Wat Trimit, which means the three friends, there's a monastery in Bangkok. There was a quite an old monastery, there was areas, parts of the monastery that were quite run down and needed fixing up. And there was one little shrine hall that was quite neglected, and so the sangha that was there at the time decided to fix it up. And there was this large Buddha image inside this space, and so they thought, well, we'll get a crane and we'll lift the Buddha image up and taken out of the building. The roof is really sharp and they've got to repair all the walls, and so we'll just drop the crane in through the roof, pick the Buddha Rupa up, take it out, put it into the courtyard, and then we can get in and fix the this shrine hall. And then they got the crane, they put these slings around the Buddha image, and they tried to lift it up, and it broke the crane. The arm of the crane kind of crumpled. They thought, wow, and they were surprised because it was the Buddha looked like it was made of clay and was painted. This paint had also worn out that was going to be restored. And they were surprised. And when the crane broke, the Buddha image dropped to the ground. There was a crack appeared in the clay. And then the abbot at the time, who was quite sort of observant, realized that under the clay there was this kind of black sort of shiny material. He thought, that's odd. It's like the kind of some sort of tar-based finish. That why would that be there? Why is that under the clay? There's no reason why you'd have a clay Buddha with that kind of strange black material. So that he thought, let's have a look. And he got a screwdriver or a knife, and he started scratching away this sort of black layer. And he saw there was some cloth and some of this black pitch. And he sort of scratched away at it, and lo and behold, there was gold underneath. And he thought, oh, interesting. So they started chipping away the all of the clay around it, and they found a solid gold image inside. It weighed 5 tons of pure gold. Not absolutely pure, but high grade. So it was a 5-ton golden image. And what they realized was that when the Thailand was being invaded, and they thought, oh, they didn't want the invading army to steal this extremely valuable image. So they covered it up with clay, painted it, And took away the decorations from around it, and they managed to for it not to be recognized, and it was left alone. But then, I guess because of the effects of the war and the struggles that went on, people forgot that was what was inside the clay image, until this happened. So now at Wat Trimit, it's kind of it's not in the little out in the side shrine hall, but it's right in the middle of the main shrine, high up in the monastery. So you can, if you go to Bangkok, you can go and visit it. But it's very much an ugly duckling story within the plain and unremarkable. It was this solid gold, 5 tons of gold image. So to continue. Again, we don't need to believe this or take it on trust. We can experiment for ourselves. When there is a peaceful moment, everything is clear and simple, selfless, beautiful. How long can the attention stay with that spaciousness, simplicity, silence? How long is it before the mind seeks another thing to have an opinion about? Similarly, when we do bring attention to that quality of inner silence, spaciousness, simplicity, notice what happens. When the heart opens to peace and simplicity, then the heart goes from being a blank space that, quote, hasn't got anything interesting in it, to the richness of the presence of Dhamma itself. Notice that. Test it out. Then we can see for ourselves how it is. In contrast, notice how food, even for the most non-sensual, is interesting, exciting when we're hungry, or when the food is of just the sort we like. Eating is a very primal activity. It's closely tied to the qualities of tanha upadana bhava, the movement from craving to clinging to becoming. An exercise that we can use to explore this is eating just one mouthful at a time. We might think that we do that already. By the way, I'm not spying on anyone or watching our eating habits, just in case you're... What have I been doing? You've been watching me. There's no cameras on anybody. This is just how we tend to be as average human beings. We might think that we do that already, but most of us don't. While we have food in our mouth, our eye is scanning the plate or the bowl, and the hand is already making preparations to get the next mouthful lined up, like an aeroplane in a holding pattern. While one plane is landing, the next one is circling. Circling the airport, waiting to land. In addition, the eye is preparing for the next descent of the utensil to select the next mouthful after that one. So you've got some in your mouth, and then you're reaching for the next with your spoon or your fork, whatever, and the eye is scanning other parts of the plate to see what comes after that. Can do. We can have three things on the go without realizing it. And we don't need to work to sustain attention on eating, for the most part. It attracts attention naturally. To counteract this unconscious habit, when we take a mouthful of food, put the food in the mouth and then put the utensil down. We're simply paying attention to the act of eating what we're eating. What a radical concept! When that mouthful is finished and the food has been swallowed, then we pick up the utensils again for the next mouthful. So that you don't have to eat in slow motion or chew each mouthful 100 times or anything of that nature, but if you just make that a practice, which I try to do, if you put in a spoonful of food or a forkful of food into your mouth, and then put the spoon down, and then just eat what you're eating. And also, you don't have to look at the bowl or the plate. Just eat what you're eating, pay attention to that, and then when you finish that mouthful, then pick up the spoon again. It's astonishing how it changes the eating experience. So I thought I would read a passage that talks about this kind of thing. This is the Brahmayu Sutta, Sutta number 91, in the Majjhima Manikaya, the middle length discourses. And this is a really interesting sutta because it's Ayu means lifespan or long life. And this is a story of an elderly Brahmin, a yogi meditator, who had heard about the Buddha, and he was quite old and not easy for him to travel, so he asked for this student to go and spend time with the Buddha and say, well, okay, this monk Gotama is supposed to be enlightened. They talk very highly about him, so can you go and visit him and spend time there and let me know, is he the real deal? Is it true what they say about him? And so the sutta is the description that when that disciple of Brahmayu went to go and stay with the Buddha, and so he's kind of spying, kind of researching, but with good intention. It's not malicious, but his job is to sort of go there and to see how he does things. And so it's one of the main parts of the Sutta Pitaka, where you have these sort of everyday descriptions of how the Buddha operated and his routines and how he lived. So one of the things is how he eats. And so this is from the Brahmayu Sutta. When he receives rice, he does not raise or lower the bowl or tip it forwards or backwards. He receives neither too little rice nor too much rice. He adds sauces in the right proportion. He does not exceed the right amount of sauce in the mouthful. He turns the mouthful over two or three times in his mouth and then swallows it, with no rice kernel entering his body unchewed, and no rice kernel remains in his mouth. Then he takes another mouthful. So he takes a mouthful of food and he eats it. And so that all the food that goes into his mouth, he chews it. So it's not like, wow, this is amazing, this is incredible. So it goes down unchewed, or you're in the middle of talking to other people and while you're eating, and the food sort of goes down without being properly chewed. If it goes in his mouth, he chews everything. And then he chews until everything is gone from his mouth. There's no rice or anything else left in his mouth. He swallows it, and then when it's swallowed, then he goes takes up the next mouthful. He takes his food experiencing the taste, though not experiencing greed for the taste. The food he takes has 8 factors. It is neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of his body, for the ending of discomfort, and for assisting the holy life. He considers, thus I shall terminate old feelings of hunger and weakness without arousing new feelings of being overfull or getting indigestion. And I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. So that's Sutta number 91, if you want to follow up more of that. Any questions on that? I don't want to intimidate people. It's a really interesting exercise to do it. When if just taking on something as simple as that, you begin to notice the habits that you have with regards to eating. If it's a kind of compulsive or habitual, or you have other sort of ways that you relate to food, just to simply pay attention to the mouthful of food that you're eating while you're eating it. I make no predictions, but often the experience is, wow, this food is really something special. Even a mouthful of plain lettuce can taste extraordinary. Why did no one ever tell me that lettuce tasted like this? I never realized. This is a very helpful way of recognizing tanha upadana bhava, craving, clinging, becoming, that outflowing process. By putting down the utensil, we're helping ourselves to witness that urge. Instead of following it, we are simply keeping the mind with the experience of feeling and perceptions. In the moments when the mind is clear, the sense of me and the world is not solid. When vijja is established, then sankhara doesn't arise. So you have avijja pachaya sankhara, the ignorance conditions formations. So avijja is the opposite of vijja, not knowing. When knowing is there and not knowing is not there, then sankhara, that basic sort of divisive subject-object duality, doesn't come into being. When vijja is established, then sankhara does not arise. It is held in check. So too, all the other 10 links of the chain. If you start off with vijja, the result is no dukkha. This is paticca nirodha, dependent cessation. There's also part of the subtitle of the book, The Buddha's Teaching on Dependent Origination Cessation. As the attention drifts, as the mind becomes unmindful, the subject-object division seems to take on a reality, and the paticca samuppada, the condition, dependent origination, the conditioned creation, that process kicks into action once again. It's most important to get a sense of how that works on our own experiential level. The dependent origination teaching is like a precise map. The most important thing is embodying and understanding the experience. So like a map, you know, it's useful insofar as it helps us to get where we need to go. It's not a matter of just understanding the map or being able to read the map. The point is to bring about that change of location, to facilitate that different attitude. So, the third exit point from the bhavachakra, the wheel of becoming, is the establishment of vijja, the awake, unobstructed heart. If that quality of awakened awareness is strong enough, the cycle is not allowed to begin at all. If that attribute is well established, ignorance can't take root and the whole cycle of addiction can't get activated. If the heart is fully awakened and aware, then dukkha is not allowed to arise, and there's a realization that there is no dukkha. It's like the image of the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree when Mara's army was attacking him, or their spears turn into beams of light and their arrows transform into flowers raining to the ground. In this way, that image of the Buddha's enlightenment is symbolic for all of us. When the mind is fully awake and aware, the pains in our body or the struggles in our family or the tangles of our world are still there, and we are sensitive to them, but the mind does not create suffering around them. It doesn't complicate or create conceptual proliferation, papancha. So when we say there is no dukkha, it doesn't mean to say there's no physical pain, or all of the arguments in your family are magically resolved. That's not what we mean. As I was mentioning, that the dukkha of dukkha nirodha is all about the second arrow. It's not about never having physical discomfort or never being hungry or everybody liking you all the time, never feeling any kind of experiencing any sort of, you know, illness or mental painful activity, like a feeling of sadness when, you know, somebody dies or there's a crisis in the world, like right now with Ukraine and Russia. That sadness can be there, that kind of physical pain can be there, but the mind doesn't have to add anything to it. You're not suppressing it, the mind is fully knowing it, appreciating it, but it's not creating complication around that. So those of you who might remember from the earlier readings, or if you were here before, so the first exit point was dukkha itself. That was and that's related to the first noble truth. So the mind can, when dukkha has arisen, that kind of anguish or difficulty, that conflict is there, then that first exit point is recognizing, you know, this is painful, this is awful, this is difficult, but this can't be the whole story. There has to be a way out. So that the first exit point is related to how the mind relates to that first noble truth, that anguish of suffering and distress. The second exit point is related to craving. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering, is tanha, craving. And the exit point is the bridge between feeling and craving, and training the mind to not cross that bridge. So this third exit point, so the first exit point is sort of link number 12, you know, the 12th in the 12 links. The second exit point is sort of links 7 and 8 on these handy diagrams that we've got here. So that the link between links 7 and 8 is the Vedana Tanha bridge. That's the second exit point. Then the third exit point is sort of back kind of at point zero, you know, back to before link number one has begun. So if link number one is ignorance, avijja, then the third exit point is at point zero before the link number one has started. So in this particular model, and again, for those, if you might remember I said before, those of you who are new to these readings, this kind of interpretation or way of talking about it, this is just me speaking. This isn't some kind of canonical or traditional sort of standard way of explaining it. It's just my own way of putting things together and describing it. And so it just, you know, it seems to work in this way. So we could have created a bit of a different description, but this seems to fit together very neatly, both from that if we are refining the practice, you know, we start off with that feeling of dukkha, and that's where we begin, and then considering the cause of that dukkha, and then also going back even further when there's mindfulness and awareness is established. So it seems to fit together very well, but again, this is just the Amara explanations. This is not some sort of classical standard formulation. So, any questions, thoughts?
Which is actually very related to Venerable's thoughts about this multiple influences or forces from previous lives or different karma. Because in that sense, our life is very much of a fixed script.
Life is what?
Fixed script.
You might say that, or you might not.
That's how I want to know how to make a difference, is to make make it not a fixed script?
I would say it is already not a fixed script, personally. Interestingly enough, when I did a psychology degree, one of the most influential things was in the third year of the studies, we looked at a book by a man called Claude Steiner called Scripts People Live. So related to another book called Games People Play. So Scripts People Live. And so I was in my third year, coming up to my final exams and wondering what I was going to do with myself and my future, my life. I had a lot of different possibilities, a lot of things I was interested in or thought I might do, but also a lot of expectations. I was always surrounded, seemingly, by expectations, people having ideas about what I should be doing, what would be good for me to do. Anyway, so there was this, okay, third year, finals coming up, what am I going to do after my finals? And what sort of career, what kind of life do I want to go into? In that book, Scripts People Live, there's a... I was really impressed with it, because there was some of the descriptions that he had, Claude Steiner, in that book, was kind of... It was like eerily accurate, like, has he been sort of following me around? Or, you know, how did he know that? How is that so... Just the dynamics of the education system or the family or Western society. It's like, wow, he's absolutely on the mark. That's exactly how it works. So I was quite impressed with how astute and accurate his reading of our life situations and how we make decisions and so on. And it's all about scripts, the scripts that we follow, and how we can feel as though... we're obligated to follow a particular script, or a script's been handed to us by our family or by the society or different things. And he outlines a number, maybe 12 or 15 different things you can do with your script. So I was impressed by this book, because there was two of the things that most struck me was, you can tear up your script or quote-unquote flip out of your script. It was helpful, because there I was, 20 years old and wondering what I was going to do with my life. And yes, there were all sorts of possibilities and people's expectations and bright ideas around me. This sense of I'm being handed this script, right? I feel I've got to follow this prescribed model. And this book and the particular insights this fellow presented was like, no, you don't. You can flip out of your script. It's like, yes, it's a script, but you don't have to follow it. Who says you have to? Or you can tear up the script, flip out of it. And so that, it was just a book, and it was just, some psychology lectures, but something went, yes, and that's possible. I do love my family, and I do recognize I have inherited a lot of blessings, and there's many potentialities. But why do I feel I have to follow a script that's handed to me? Aha! So there was this. It had a strangely strong effect. It was just a book. And we were studying it in this class, but it revealed that sense of my script is fixed. I've got to do this. I should. People expect, or what will they think if I don't? And I kept noticing, who is this they that I'm trying to please? Who are they? Where are they? Why should that be the defining factor? And it hit something very sort of strong and intuitive in me. And so, as it turned out, the one thing that everybody seemed to be okay with, any possibility that I came up with or what I talked about, some people liked and some people didn't like. Anyhow, cut a long story short, the one thing that everyone seemed to be happy with was if I said, I'm going to go and travel around the world for a few years and see what happens. They're like, oh, good idea, good idea. So just kind of on the basis of just not trying to avoid the grief of explaining that I had the idea of being a dustman in Brighton. I wanted to be a garbage collector. I thought it was a very nice, humble life to have. And they say the Brighton dump was famous for having all kinds of interesting things you can find there. I ran that past my dad, and he was very unimpressed with my idea of me being a dustman in Brighton. I thought it was quite a good idea. I had the idea of being a wandering storyteller. I thought I'd build a canoe and then just sort of live have a canoe and paddle around the waterways and canals of England, be like a wandering storyteller and just live on the random offerings of people as I sit around campfires and visit pubs and tell tales. So I kind of ended up doing that. I didn't have the canoe. I haven't got the canoe, but I'm not making any hints, by the way. But all kinds of things. I thought of being an actor, and also my godfather was a partner of De Beers Diamond Corporation. So I had an opening at De Beers Diamonds that I could have walked into. All sorts of things. But then people were happy with the idea of me going traveling, so okay, I'll do that. And so 4 months after I left on my travels, I wandered into Wat Pa Nanachat. So that didn't take very long. But that having that imagery of being able to just flip out of the script, just leave the script behind and walk away from it, or just tear up the script, and that was a very helpful image, because it also revealed, as I was reading that book and had that sense of, oh, this guy really knows how the mind works and how we follow these patterns that are given to us, or that we assume are true and have to be followed. And so I felt this person understands how it works, and then those possibilities that you can just leave that script behind. So that was when I arrived at the monastery in northeast Thailand, Wat Pa Nanachat, and this tremendous faith and interest, you know, immediately arose, like within days, 2 or 3 days, like it was like, yes, this is exactly what I'd be looking for. Then the thought crossed my mind a couple of weeks later, there is no way that my parents are ever, ever, ever going to understand this. This is really out of my script. This never even crossed my mind, let alone their mind, this kind of thing. Joining an orthodox monastic order off of the other side of the world in a religion I'd never even been interested in, knew anything about. But then, just on that note, what happened was I was sweeping the path in front of my kuti one afternoon, and a thought crossed my mind that there's absolutely no way that my parents, you know, very, very middle of the road, average English class, English middle class people, how they would ever understand this or tolerate it or be able to live with this, you know, their son becoming, their only son becoming a Buddhist monk. At the age of 21, and the thought crossed my mind: maybe I should, you know, go back to England and, you know, get a straight job and marry a nice girl and have curly haired children who have lovely table manners, you know, run around in the garden and win prizes at school, and that'll make them happy. It was kind of all there in a moment, like a second. It was just, maybe I should just do that, and then. So in the same second, it was like this very powerful intuitive sense of like, no, it wouldn't be kind to you, and it wouldn't be kind to them, or the people that you ended up living with or being parent of, because you would just be doing that for the sake of fulfilling somebody else's script. I don't know, I didn't think of it in exactly those words. It was just, it was a kind of wordless recognition. And so, the kindest thing you can do is to follow this motivation of being here, and then sooner or later they'll either understand or not. But you won't be performing you won't be living according to a lie. You won't be performing some sense of actions that your heart really isn't in. And it was strange. It was like it was just there in a second. The whole thing was very, very, very quick. And so then I started to think, okay, how am I going to tell them? So that was tricky. But I would recommend, just going back to your question, that sense of fixity of the script. Okay, this is the feeling of it's fixed. Is that so? Who says? Who are they that will be upset or distressed or who who are expecting this, you know, this particular script to be followed. Why should it be followed? Yeah, and just maybe there's some immediate answers like mum and dad, you know, or that comes up and says, well, you know, who are they really? Yes, they are our parents, but you know, not out of disrespect or out of love or care, but because not to sort of dwell on my own story, but it was, yes, that's the expectation of my parents, but even they didn't fulfill the expectations of their parents. So why, you know, why? And then my grandfather and grandmother, they didn't do that either. Like my father's father, he came out of they had a building firm, Ashby and Horner, in London. And my grandfather flipped out of the whole thing and went off and trained to be a doctor in Aberdeen, I think. I went to the furthest end of Britain he could go to get out of the family business and become a doctor. And then my grandmother, it's kind of uncertain where she came from, but they got married in Brighton, where none of the family lived. So he was a trainee of the doctor in Aberdeen, and then where did she come from? And they got married in Brighton, where they weren't living, and nobody knew them there, so... Okay, it sounds like granddad and grandma were kind of moving out of the field. So sometimes that sense of obligation, I'm not trying to disrupt your family life, but sometimes that sense of meeting particular people's expectations, it's like, well, what makes that so solid or so real? What makes that so absolute? And to, you know, you trust that you care, that you love various people, or you have respect for society's values. But just to take that question, well, who says this is absolutely important? Who says this has got some kind of substantial reality? These are just human agreements, you know, expectations, mind states. There's no thing solid there, really. And it's not an idea that we're convincing ourselves of, but you're in this process of reflection and exploring and challenging those assumptions, you're drawing upon that intuitive sense, that which knows these are just agreements, they're just ideas, it's just habit. That there's no thing really there. And then when we come from that place, and then it makes, even though you have to phrase things carefully, like, how can I tell? How can I break this to mum and dad? You, because you're coming from that reliable and intuitive place of wisdom and attunement, then the heart finds a way through it. So yeah, it took about 15 years for my family to get around to it, but eventually. So I hope that. But I recommend we might have a copy of that in the library. Claude Steiner. Scripts People Live. So I will leave it there on the brink of Papuncha for today.
Anna Mayang Dhamma Wada Kataya Sadhu Karanda Dhamma Se
Sadhu Sadhu.